You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Mike Foster. Mike, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you so much.
So, Mike, the way we start the show is it's an example of how we get to know each other here in the region. And so what we start with is, who are you? And that's just kind of that's a huge, big question, but you take it whatever way you want. Qualities, labels, whatever you want. And we'll spend a few minutes with it, and then we'll cut to music.
That sounds good. That is a big question.
Yep.
I'm an ox. I was recently reading through Proverbs, and I came across this verse that just blew my mind. You know, I've read it 1,000 times, but it talks about how where there is no ox, the stable is clean, but an ox accomplishes much thing. I'm like, that's me. That's me. I'm the dude that has the drive. I want to get things done, but I can be messy.
Right. No, I get it. So that's the quality as a person. You're a doer. You're big. You're a big guy. You're a thick guy. You're not a tall guy, but you're a big guy. So what else do we need to know about you to start this conversation?
My life underwent an incredibly radical transformation. Who I am today is so very far from the life that I lived for a long time. I'm just over 8 years and a month sober. My life in alcoholism and using drugs was a very unpleasant experience, man. I was filled with suicidal rage. I was like a suicidal Darth Vader, if that's what you can imagine.
No, I can. I most certainly can. So you brought some music, and you wanted to start with Memphis Mayfire, No Yes. Ordinary Love. Do you want to say something about this music before we start?
Absolutely. Sure. What I love about this song, he's talking about he's just a broken man. And he has an encounter with God's love, which is unlike anything he has ever experienced before in his life. It's just not like an ordinary kind of love. It's not dependent on circumstance or if it's deserved. It's just based on the preciousness of the object love. And when I encountered that, it was a life-changing experience for me.
And you encountered it through Christian metal.
Largely, yes. It was a big experience for me when I learned I could listen to metal and not be wrapped up in hate and negativity, that there is that style of music can be enjoyed in a very, very, very positive way.
Well, I think you're not the first person to bring metal music to the show, but you are the first person to bring Christian metal to the show.
Right on.
So here we go. Memphis Mayfire, No Ordinary Love.
Someone just tell me which way to go. I need a sign, I need a miracle. I need to know that this is possible. I've just felt so many times. Is there any way that I can make it right? God, if you're there, I need to hear you now. Come back to me, love, I forgive you. Oh, how I've missed you. Just know every time you're right, I'll be right here waiting. Oh, sees unseen, unsure of what to believe, just dying to be loved. When love's right in front of us, we give up on our hopes and dreams, and let doubt take everything.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Mike Foster. And Mike, that line from Memphis Mayfire is, I tried to save myself, but I failed.
Yes.
So what about metal? What about that music?
That for the longest time, I tried to go through life trying to control things that I have no control over. And when you're trying to control something that just can't be controlled, it leaves you in a perpetual state of frustration, depression, anxiety.
So what were you trying to control?
I would try to, protect my emotions from being hurt. Injustice has always been something that has greatly disturbed me.
And sensitive for yourself and sensitive for others.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And the moment that I realized I could listen to the music I love, heavy music,
right,
and still have a positive experience with it and be able to share a positive experience with others was one of the last nights that I drank, and I was drunk and I had a shotgun in my mouth. And I heard this song that had just the most brutal breakdown. You know, the guitars were so heavy. And I actually stopped to say, what is this guy saying? And it was a Christian band. Uh-huh. And it blew my mind that something could be positive and I could still listen to metal. You know, I grew up in a church that was very, very, very conservative. Uh-huh. And the idea of listening to metal, I mean, the idea of listening to anything that was not hymns or worship music was just highly frowned upon.
And sedate.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Where did you grow up?
I was born in New Jersey. Uh-huh. Stillwater, New Jersey. My parents moved up to this area when I was 9 years old to Richford, which is about half an hour out of Ithaca. Yeah. There's a couple trees there, and that's about it.
I know Richford. Actually, that's where the original Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, was born.
Yeah,
Okay. So wow. So you have not gotten far from home geographically, but you've gotten far. When did you discover yourself? Discovered that drugs and alcohol were taking over your life.
You know,
how old were you, basically?
I was 25.
Uh-huh.
I should have discovered much earlier. Everybody around me that cared about me tried to point out all of the destruction and consequences that were happening in my life, and I just refused to see it. And I believed a lie. I kind of fell into a mindset of, I'm a screw up and I'm just always going to be a screw up. So I'm just going to drown it in the way that I see fit.
Right.
At 25, I woke up strapped to a bed in the hospital because I had a failed suicide attempt and I had no choice but to detox while I was in the hospital. I was strapped to the bed because I was combative. When they let me leave my room, all there was a common area, and all there was in this common area was a bookshelf. And the only thing I saw on the bookshelf that I knew was a Bible, so I grabbed it. And I just randomly opened it up to some things that spoke into my life in a new way that had never affected me. I kind of had an experience of, this does not say what I was taught in church, it says.
Uh-huh. So what was the difference?
The growing up in, at least in the church that I grew up in, it was more like you were invited into a relationship with the rules, which was not life-giving in any way. It was sort of the aspect of, you're not good enough and you have to do good enough or else God is going to be mad at you. And in reading what Jesus actually taught, it was purely based on love. It was purely based on compassion. It was, I am good enough and I give you your identity. I'm not inviting you into a relationship with the rules. I'm inviting you into a connection with me. You are able to know the character of God, the nature of God in an experiential way. And it was something that was so much more life-giving than trying to be good enough to meet a set of expectations.
I want to sit with this for a little while because you're talking about something that we often don't really think about, because we can kind of, some of us who've come out of religion or rejected religion have rejected it because of its rule boundness.
Absolutely.
But we live in a culture that's driven by policies and rules and getting it right and looking good in front of people. And that's the same stuff, whether it's religious or not.
Yes.
And what you're talking about is a way of connecting, that is immediate.
Yes.
And what I would call, and this is something we often don't think about, is that connection is immediate. It's not necessarily feel good.
Right.
it's an immediate connection, and you may be in extreme anger or pain or frustration or conflict,
yes.
but there is no boundary. There's no division between you and the other.
Absolutely.
And so when you live with that kind of immediate, honest conflict, it kind of holds you in a quality of accountability that's inside yourself and not outside yourself.
Yes, and you know, our culture, particularly Western culture, is very much driven by the idea that if something is unpleasant to go through, it's bad. And that's not necessarily the case. My biggest steps forward have come out of the deepest brokenness in my life, the deepest hurt, the deepest suffering. The largest growth has come out of those things. It's not that it's a pleasant experience to go through. It's that those experiences can leave me in a much better situation than I was going in.
And how do they do that? Give us some examples if you can.
Sure. So there has to come a point, in my sobriety. So I had that experience in 2005. Mm-hmm. Started to put together some time sober. It was about a year and a half, and then a long term relationship ended, and I went to the bottom of a bottle for another year.
Yep.
At the end of that, my plan at that point was pretty much just, I was just going to drink until I die.
Yeah.
Life hurts too much. It's too hard. I tried a tiny little bit and it didn't work out. So I was at the point where I would, I was laying on my floor. I would hit my bottle of vodka. I would throw up blood on the other side of the floor, hit my bottle of vodka, pass out. And some friends of mine literally picked me up and started carrying me to AA meetings. And I didn't care about any of it. You know, I sat there for months not caring. There finally had to come a point of honesty with myself where I said, I have tried everything that I possibly can. Uh-huh. So I am willing to try giving up control, living life God's way, experiencing this heart connection versus just trying to follow a set of rules that I will never be good enough to follow perfectly.
Right.
And out of the brokenness of being able to say, I give up control, I am willing to try anything for life to become something different than what it has been,
right,
created the largest steps forward. And it's very uncomfortable. It forces me to go out of my comfort zone.
So there's kind of a paradox. When you give up control, you're actually taking control.
Yes.
And saying no. So what was that like? What did that involve?
It was terrifying. Everything that I was comfortable with, which what I was comfortable with had never worked.
So who did you, I mean, so I hear that, when you do that, you start listening to people and engaging other people in
sure.
a different way. What did you hear then that you didn't hear before? What did you do then that you didn't do before?
One thing I started doing was I started going around to churches. I started to see the effects of community. There were people that I looked up to and I respected, and I wanted what I saw in them, and they all had something in common. They all had a community of people around them that were moving in the direction they wanted to move in life. The community that I had around me was not moving in the direction I wanted to go in. It was just stagnant in that area of so much pain and anguish. And it was like, you know, when trying to come to a different point in life, you think of lobsters getting cooked in a pot. One of them starts to crawl out.
Yeah.
He starts to get free, and all the others grab onto him, and all they do is just pull him back down.
Yeah.
I had lots of horrible church experiences, and I had a really good one with a local church that I went to for a while that was really big on community. You know, the focus of it was not the Sunday morning service. The focus of it was connection with small groups of people throughout the week. And there was an aspect of that of just being brutally honest about what's going on in life and just doing life together with each other. You could be honest about your struggles and what you were dealing with, whereas the church culture I grew up in, you could not be honest about your struggles. If you walked in the Sunday morning, absolutely. Yeah, there was acceptance in this group.
Right, right. And what you describe, I want to, a lot of times, you know, so we have this kind of, if you don't live up to the mark, you get cut out.
Yes.
So that's a social status thing, and that can happen whether you're religious or
whether you're
on the treadmill for life successes. But there's another way you kind of get cut out, and that is some people confuse community, the solidarity that comes with honest community, with the solidarity that comes with politically being on the same side.
Yeah.
And that's not the same thing.
That's
a very, very different thing. And so my, you know, on the left, we tend to conflate, you know, being on each other's side with being honest with each other. And there's a lot of, it's not helpful. And it's also very fragile. I mean, and so I guess what I'm, I don't want to diss the other, because knowing how things work somewhat objectively, rule-based, is important.
Yes.
But knowing how to engage in that thin place where there's almost no boundary between us, where we're really directly responsive and responsible to and for each other, that's precious.
Very much.
And they're both of these things have values, but when you are suffering from addiction, it's almost like you're trying to get the thin place, but you're stuck in the other place, and the alcohol or the drugs give you the illusion. I mean, this is a speculative comment, but you know, I'm seeing it play out in people's lives, that the lack of the absence of a community of honest solidarity leaves people susceptible.
Sure, sure. And you know, in my addiction, fell into this place of what honestly is deception, of this is real. Like, the party life is real. These people are real. And you guys are all fake with everything that you're talking about, whether it's your spiritual life, your political life, anyone who is not like me, you're fake. And it was a lie that I believed when I was in a context of community where I could be honest about the brokenness that I'm experiencing. I experienced love and acceptance on a level that I had never known before. And there's such a deeply seated need in humanity to be loved, to be accepted, to be part of the tribe, you know?
Right. And even when you use that language, it can be misunderstood. Because to be loved and accepted as part of the tribe, but the tribe has no walls.
Sure.
The tribe, when it is honest, it welcomes everybody, whether you're a believer or not.
Sure.
And that's where many people want to put the walls back up and create a certain measure of dishonesty.
Yes.
Let's cut to a piece of music, and then I want to come back to some of these themes, because this is really rich. What do we need to go to next?
We're going to go to a song called Need to Be, which is another song by Memphis Mayfire. It's a lot more laid back. But what I love about this song is, from his perspective, he's talking about his interactions with the band's fans, letters they receive, interactions at shows with people who are genuinely broken, and they're desperately seeking for some way to meet the needs, the longings they have inside them, to be loved, to be accepted, to experience healing in the brokenness in their lives. And in the work that I do, working with the homeless, this is what I strive to be. This is what I want to be. This is the kind of man I want to be.
Wow. Okay.
Different than them.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that was Memphis Mayfire, Need to Be. And our guest on this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Mike Foster. So, Mike, what is it that you've learned that you need to be?
I've learned I need to be love on the deepest possible level, compassion. When I read through the New Testament and Jesus's compassion is shown and talked about, I at least for one, largely misunderstood for a large portion of my life what compassion is.
What did you think it was?
I thought it was sympathizing with the misery somebody is going through. But the Greek word, it has so much more of a meaning to that. It's made up of two different words. The first word does carry that idea, sympathizing with the misery someone is going through. But the second word is taking specific action to remove that misery. It's a manifestation of your sympathy shown in your action. I can sit in my house all day long and I can talk about what should be done. If I don't go do it, I am not showing compassion to people. I want the compassion God has shown me. I want people to experience that because it's been the most amazing thing I've ever experienced.
Right. And one of the things that sometimes startles Christians, and I had when I was in seminary, there was a great sermon on this. We believe in a pathetic God.
Yes, we do.
And our God is pathetic because those passions or pathos are part of the reality of that we have to come to terms with. And when you share those, which I think is what you are alluding to here, it's not something that you just have a feeling for the other. Yes. You actually enter into a sense of solidarity with sharing with the other the life that they're going through. So that in some sense, it becomes easier for both of you.
It does. That's been a big part of me being that ox. You know what I mean?
I hadn't thought about it in that way. Yeah.
I started really getting motivated with those things. I was in church on a Sunday morning, and a man came in who was very mentally ill, and he was a scary kind of guy, but he was pushed to the outside. And nowhere do I see Jesus say, love people unless they're scary. Love people unless it's uncomfortable. He just says, love people, all people. Who is your neighbor that you're supposed to love? Anybody that needs it. Anybody.
And admit that you're scared.
Yes.
The point is, I grew up in a tradition where sometimes you had to deny your feeling. But no, if you want to love somebody who's scary, you got to admit that they're
absolutely
scary.
Absolutely. And out of that experience, I wanted to create a place where anyone could come to and feel safe, whether they were mentally ill, whether they were active in their addiction, no matter what their sexual orientation is, no matter what their ethnicity is. Everybody is welcomed into that love of Christ the same way. And I started a church that met at the Chanticleer Bar. We would meet on the second floor of the bar. The music that we played, we had a rock band set up, and we played things in a more of a metal kind of way than in a typical church kind of way. Right. And people would just wander in here and there, and they would be shocked at the fact they could sit down and drink a beer during this church service we were doing. It was a really cool experience, and it was out of my community outreach with that is what wound up with where I am at the Rescue Mission now.
So how did that church experience go, and how did you segue into the rescue mission? Or are you still doing that church?
No, when I started with the rescue mission, I stopped doing that church at the bar because I just couldn't pull double duty.
Yeah.
It was a big part of what we did with the church at the bar. It was called Rise Up. A big part of Rise Up was at least once a month, we had something that we did out in the community. There were times we just walked the streets picking up garbage. We cooked a dinner and had dinner with the firefighters at the department one night just to show them they were loved. When Hurricane Sandy hit, we drove down to New Jersey and we stayed a couple nights down there distributing food to people who had been in power outages for 2 weeks and were in poverty and lost any surplus of food that they had.
Yeah.
So there was this big push on actually being out in the community and doing things, showing love to people with no strings attached.
Yep.
I'm not trying to convert somebody. I'm not trying to proselytize somebody. Just purely, you are loved.
Yeah. And you know, I'm going to state the obvious here. You are loved, and you express it in an unselfconscious and an un, how do I want to say it? An undemanding way.
Yes.
But a lot of people who carry baggage about religion, you know, meet that language with the baggage.
Yeah.
How do you try to cut through? I mean, I've seen you in action in a couple of situations, and I get it. But a lot of people aren't going to trust that you really welcome anybody.
Absolutely.
And so what do you do with people's doubt and their distrust and their pushing you back?
You know, a big thing is consistency. While doing Rise Up, I started reaching out to the homeless population in Ithaca, going down to the jungle, actually getting to know these guys. And that's how I wound up working for the rescue mission in the position I'm in now. I mean, there was no aspect of you just meet somebody once and they automatically trust you and think everything is okay. There had to be months of me continuously building this relationship for people who are living in a very defensive way, really for the sake of their emotional and physical survival, to realize this person genuinely cares about me and is just trying to help me.
Right.
There has to be a serious and consistent approach in actually building a relationship with somebody, getting to know them, getting to know who they are, being vulnerable myself and letting them know who I am.
Yeah, and probably showing them that you can speak their language and not just have to speak your own language.
Yes, very much.
And that I think is, from my own experience, there are two things that cripple congregational communities. One is the expectation that we speak the same language rather than being open to each other and figuring out what it means along the way. And the other one is wanting things to be too fast.
Yes.
It takes years to work
very much,
through stuff.
Very much.
And you know, I went to a seminary where the author of the Serenity Prayer was a professor for many, many years. And that prayer is, you know, God grant me I'm gonna have to remember the clause. The courage to change the things I can, the wisdom to accept the things I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yes.
You know, but he was a man who was known for running up and down the stairs of the seminary. That was his reputation until he had a stroke, which disabled him in his late 50s. But he didn't understand in that formulation that came from the 20s or 30s when everything was in a hurry in this country. He didn't, 1920s or 30s, he didn't understand that you got to have the time.
Yes.
You got to have the time and the patience and slow down.
Yes. Yes, I think a very huge part of showing the love I see in Christ to people is a giving of time. And so many people talk about tithe purely as a financial thing. I think a tithe is giving of your time too. We all have time. We all
the only
can
thing
find
we all
a few
have
minutes.
Is time on
yes.
some level.
Yes.
Wow. You're listening to WRFI Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Mike Foster. So Mike, what have you learned that you didn't expect to learn in these 8 years of sobriety and these 8 years of trying to live what you call the love, the unconditional love of God?
Yeah. You know, that's just, that love in and of itself is a big thing that I have learned. If you would have seen me when I was active in my addiction, probably the most common phrase you would have heard me say is, I hate people. I mean, there's this song by a band called Mara called Pure Hatred, and the chorus is, I hate everyone. And I used to crank that and roll my windows down so everybody knew how angry I was.
Anybody who tried to come up, they would run away.
Yes.
You'd drive them away.
Yes. The shift in compassion for people, but a learning of what I had grown up with being exposed to as the Christian religion was not what Jesus taught. I had deeply held beliefs for no other reason than my whole life. That's what I had been told.
Right.
And through this experience of as an adult, seeing what Jesus taught on my own, looking into that and studying that, everything is about the heart. It's all about the position of the heart towards God. We see church often by what's called a centered set model, which if you picture a circle and in the center of that circle is Jesus. And if you're inside the circle, you're good. And if you're outside the circle, you're not welcome.
You're confined to the outer
darkness. I see it more as a model where, or I'm sorry, that's called the bound set model. I see it more as the centered set model where Jesus is in the center, and the person who is 1,000 miles away but facing towards him has their heart in a much better position than the person that's 10 feet away from him and facing away.
What, and I want to, because I want to get at something slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
In the time since your, and I'm going to call it a conversion experience.
Sure.
In the time since your conversion experience, how is what you thought you were converting to different than what you thought it was?
Because you
do accept that. I mean, you talk about the love from the prior time.
Yeah.
I'm talking about more, you know, from a year or two out after that experience to now. How is it different?
There's a couple ways it's different. One, it's different is in a, it's not always that cloud nine feel good kind of thing. It doesn't necessarily feel good all of the time to be open and to be vulnerable. There's in the last 8 years of trying to become the man that I want to be and maintaining sobriety, I've gone through difficult things, man. You know, my father passed away, a marriage ended, and understanding that this love does not mean everything is easy, everything is fair, everything is simple and peachy all the time.
The thin place or the solidarity isn't about the absence of conflict or feeling good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's, frankly, it's uncomfortable a lot of the times. You know, one of the things I first clearly felt God say to me was, Mike, I don't care about your comfort zone. I do not believe God is concerned with my comfort zone.
So what did that, how did that change you? What did that make you realize?
It made me realize that for other people that are in our community that are experiencing brokenness, I need to be willing to go out of my comfort zone. I can tell you a great example. When I was doing Rise Up to Bar Church, I had to hang up flyers for the service, and I had worked a long day, and I came home and the sky was just black, and it was going to storm. Yeah. I was like, I'm tired. It's going to storm. I'm going to lay down and I'm going to do this another time. And I laid down and I had such a strong sensation that I sat straight up in bed. I felt like God was saying to me, you need to go out and you need to do this now. And I'm like, no, but I'm tired. And so I was at a point then where I had enough experience when I have a conviction that strong and I don't follow through with it, I feel just so terrible that I'm willing to step out of my comfort zone and do something that seems completely ridiculous to me.
Right. So you're listening to different parts of yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I take these flyers and I'm walking down the road. It's thunder. It's lightning. It's pouring rain. You know, I'm muttering under my breath, does this count as martyrdom if I get hit as lightning out here? And I'm trying to hang posters up and they're falling apart in my hands. And then I walk down the alleyway that's halfway down the commons that cuts over to Green Street.
Sure.
And there is nobody out because nobody in their right mind is out walking around in the storm.
Right.
And there's just this gigantic soaking wet dude walking towards me from the other end of the alleyway. And I'm like, okay, this is how I die. And this big beastly dude goes, hey. And I'm like, what's up, man? And he goes, do you go to church? And I said, well, yeah, I do. Why? And this dude, complete stranger, for some reason just starts opening up about how his wife had just left him. He'd been walking around downtown. Their son had gotten drunk 2 years ago, had passed out in the snow and had died. His wife had not been able to recover from it. He lost his son. He lost his wife. This dude is just purely broken, out wandering around in this thunderstorm. And, you know, we have this conversation. And I pray a quick prayer with him. He's like, no, I don't want you to pray with me because it's going to look awkward. And I'm like, brothers, there's literally no one else out here but me. Yeah. Yeah. And it was just a quick prayer. You know, it was God, just let this dude feel your peace. And you could see, I mean, his shoulders lowered, just his whole body language, his demeanor relaxed and became so much more peaceful. And he said, what was that? I'm like, that's God's presence. That's the way that you are loved.
Yeah.
And so being able to listen not to the voices of fear and what sometimes I think are the voices of reason, but to be able to listen to a different part of me that says, hey, you need to go out and do this right now, and it's not necessarily going to make sense to you. Yeah. I've had so many amazing encounters with people.
Yeah. And I want to honor that, and I want to move back to the notion of peace.
Yeah.
Peace is not about our happiness or feeling good or it's not even pleasant. It's just
sure.
being able to accept something sure. and work within it.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And if a person who is fighting the demon of why couldn't it have been different? Why yeah. does it have to be this? Yeah. Why is it bearing me down so hard? To just say, sit, I'll sit with you a while.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That aspect yeah. of just spending human time with a person that is hurting.
And it's and that is a quality of peace that we often don't yes. really honor.
Yes. One of the Greek words used is peace in the New Testament. It's a word that means the binding back together of what has been separated. And the polar opposite of that word in the Greek language was the word for anxiety, because that's the pulling apart of everything. And yeah. so the aspect of having what has been pulled apart bound back together doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't hurt anymore. What yeah. you experienced was yeah. fair. It's a level of acceptance and serenity about the situation.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, the word religare, which is the Latin word for religion, can also be, your religion is what you do when your world falls apart, because it's how you religament it, how you
yes,
bind it back together
yes.
again. And the ligaments are what hold the body or hold the whole together.
Yes, beautiful picture.
And yeah. Let's go to music. What did you like to go to next?
You got it. Next song is a song by a band called Fit for a King, and it's called A Greater Sense of Self. The song is about a man who has been trying to live right and goes through a very painful experience, and he's basically crying out, wasn't what I did enough? Can't you see how hard I'm trying? Why does this have to be so difficult? And through that experience, that pain, he gains a greater understanding of who he really is, the way that God actually sees him and what his identity really is.
Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Mike Foster. So, Mike, when you are you are in the lives of people who have severe addiction issues, homelessness, mental illness, yes, all sorts of issues that many of us, I mean, it's not only emotionally and intellectually tough, it can smell really bad.
Oh, yeah.
and just be incredibly kind of push every button in us. How do you, I mean, this is what you're called to do now.
Yes.
And how do you understand that vocation that you have now? Where is it heading, or do you need to even ask that question?
I don't necessarily think that aspect of being immersed in the lives of people experiencing brokenness is ever going to change. I was so hopeless for so long in my own life. I have to be where people don't have hope so I can share with them that there actually is hope. I have my entire life, I have always been fired up about injustice. I mean, mm-hmm. all the way back to middle school, I was the kid that was always sticking up for the underdog and, you know, fighting with the bullies. So I have to be with people who do not experience hope because I want them to know that life does not have to be what it's been for so long. In my position at the rescue mission, I had started out as the chaplain, which was completely immersed in people constantly. I was promoted to the program manager, and what was really cool is I basically carved out that program manager position as they worked with me because I said, I cannot be removed from the people. I just can't be that dude that's stuck behind a desk all the time. I have to be with these people. I love these people. Uh-huh. So at least half of every day is planned out, spent so I'm engaging with the people in our community that are in need of those services.
Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? What does that look like? What are you doing?
It's so many different things. It can be simply just sitting and talking with someone about what they're going through. We provide meal services. We provide a food pantry service, coordinating people with different resources that are around town to help with housing issues when they're on the verge of homelessness, working with people that are actually in the shelter to move into housing. Housing is very, very difficult in Ithaca.
You're looking at a
0.5% rental availability. What is available in that 0.5% is largely never going to be affordable by someone who is working a minimum wage job.
Yep.
So housing options are very difficult, and honestly, they're quite unfair. A lot of times people are faced with your only option is to take this single room that is dirty, and you're surrounded by a very bad environment, and people are trying to get sober, and
right,
they're working
right,
to overcome
right.
their addiction, and their only option is to go into this place where they're surrounded by people that are very much active in their addiction, and it's heartbreaking, it's frustrating, it takes a thick skin and I think a very specific personality to be in that day in and day out and immersed in people's lives that are really revolving around a lot of conflict and a lot of chaos.
Yeah. 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 And that's the person going out to try to find a space to live, right?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And they're trying to, we demand a lot of people who have already been through a lot.
Absolutely.
And that's, I want to go back. I'm going to come back to this. But you mm-hmm. you described you in middle school as being the kid who stood up for the underdog, who fought with the bullies. And,
yeah.
And I have I have this image that one of the trajectories of youth is that kids who take on more than they can handle when they're young like that, oftentimes end up medicating the urges with alcohol or drugs because what they've tried to fix outside, they don't know how to fix inside,
right.
and they become completely disillusioned, and
right.
so it becomes a mess. And it's not that addiction is, I mean, there may be a biological cause or a biological connection, but there's a big piece of just not learning how to deal with what you cannot change.
Yes.
And if we were much better at an earlier age with people learning how to be in intimate relationship with pain.
Yes.
In solidarity
yes.
with suffering rather than keeping it at a distance and objectifying it, we would be in a lot better place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's so much of an aspect, you know, as I'm a parent, I have a 13-year-old son, and there's a very natural emotional feeling I have for him to, I don't want him to experience something unpleasant. Right. You know, I don't want him to experience suffer. I don't want him to experience heartbreak. But the reality of the situation is if I try to protect him from all that, it's just going to blow up on him later in life because he's not equipped to deal with what life actually is. The best thing I think I can do in that moment is walk that suffering with him, walk that pain with him. Let him know no matter what you are going through, I'm in this with you and you are loved.
Right. And it's not teach him a lesson.
Right.
It's walk with him through the lessons that he's learning.
He's got to figure out things on his own.
We lived in a generation of people who were trying to teach their kids lessons.
Yes.
And that's a mockery. That's objectifying it and pushing it out. And that's not living
absolutely
in the moment.
Absolutely.
And that's, yeah. Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. You remind me of the fellow who was my best friend as a young kid. His dad was in prison and actually died there in his 30s. And one of the things that his dad had done is hung him up by his overall straps from a porch swing hook on the front porch because he didn't want to look after him and he didn't want to get in trouble. And that's terrifying for a kid who's, you know, 3-4 years old.
Sure.
Anyway, so... he was given the name of his father, but he went by his middle name instead. But one of the ways that he came to peace with this in his own rage, he was a musician. His way out was to get out with music. And he played, he had a standing invitation with Willie Nelson's stage in Branson, Missouri. But what he did was he ended up, after he got through the drugs and the alcohol and stuff and sorting himself out and having a semi-successful career, he ended up being the guy who could go and talk the kids out of the hills and the bluffs of the Missouri River because he could relate to that despair. And it's a powerful quality. And his brother, his father died in his 30s from a heart disease, and his older brother, this my friend's older brother, died in his early 30s from heart disease. And he's still alive, but he's not healthy.
Right.
So, but anyway, it's... but that kind of commitment is... he couldn't have lived without acting on it.
Right.
And I sense the same kind of drive once you get clear about it. And we weren't clear how to be in that suffering with each other. We grew up in a place where one out of 20 of our peers wouldn't make it to 20.
Right.
Age 20 because of drugs or alcohol or violence or bad health care or a litany of other issues. So what I want to know from you is what do you do on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly, yearly, to restore yourself intellectually, emotionally, physically? What do you do to take care of yourself? And when do you know you need to do it?
It's a great question. Self-care is one of the things that is so often overlooked by anyone that's doing any kind of service work. So many people experience burnout, experience compassion fatigue, which is also called secondary traumatic stress, because not only you're giving so much, you're surrounded by people who are suffering so much. For me personally, there's a couple things I have to maintain. You know, I get bored really easy, man. So I've kind of found cycles of things to just get my mind to shut down for a little while. I'm a musician. I play music. So, you know, for a few months, I'm going to be all about my guitar and my bass, and I'm writing music. And that starts to get a little boring. And for a few months, I'm going to be all about video games. I love video games, man. I don't care if I'm 36. I love video games. I love reading. I love just the concept, process of learning. It's very life-giving for me. So I'll go through these cycles where I'm just reading books left and right and devouring things. I've got a whole room in my apartment that's just all bookshelves. My fiance is always telling me to get rid of the books. I'm like, no, the books just need to pile up higher. My prayer time is very important. I have to have time to just sit and be quiet and listen. You know, for a long time, I considered prayer to just be me speaking to God.
Me talking to God rather than listening.
And if I'm not listening to what he's saying back to me, I'm pretty much wasting my time.
Right. And you are, what I want, because this is some place where some people kind of trip. When you're sitting in silence, you may be hearing the echo of your mind.
Oh, yes.
But you may also be hearing things that other people have said.
Yes.
Didn't penetrate.
Absolutely.
That is a wonderful place to be.
It is.
When did you learn, or how did you learn that you could be silent with yourself? you could be still and silent with yourself?
I had an experience that was probably 7 or 8 months after I got sober. A friend of mine was going to a church to hear this woman speak that was from Australia. Mm-hmm. She was probably 90 years old. And I didn't really want to go, but I went just to make him happy. And she got done speaking and she came over and sat down next to me and she asked me my name. And I said, my name's Mike. And she leans over and she says, Mike, God says stop the BS. Except she didn't say BS. She really said it and forgot her microphone was on and it echoed through the whole church. And so
you were called out.
She spoke my language. Uh-huh, she spoke my language. She connected with me and she said, do you ever just spend time quiet listening to God and write down what you think he's saying? And I was like, no, I never have done that. Uh-huh. And she showed me notebooks that she has. And I said, well, it can't hurt. Let's give it a shot and see what God is saying to me. What do you want to do with my life? And so I would begin to sit silently with a pen and a notebook, and that pen didn't move for about 3 months.
Yeah.
And over time, it would be a word, a couple words, and it's really never more than maybe a few sentences that I feel like is something being spoken deeply into my soul. If someone comes to me with saying an entire notebook of last night, this is what God said to me, I'm like, that's more than God said to Moses, so I don't think that's all God. Yeah. So it was a process of the discipline and writing it down so I could go back and look at it. Right. And I could see things come to fruition in my life and say, yeah, I really think this was God speaking into my life, or this was just my own wishful thinking, or these were just negative thoughts trying to creep in.
So the silence precedes the awareness.
Yes.
And for me, I worked construction. I took a leave of absence from college because I was not doing well. Worked construction, and then I'm running with a bunch of people coming from a commune who are trying to come back into mainstream society. And they taught me how to meditate one summer, and this was the summer of 1979. And over the course of 2 or 3 months, sitting for an hour twice a day, I could sit for the hour, and when things would come into my mind, I could say, I acknowledge you, I'm not going to deal with you.
Yeah.
And I would let them go, and I would let them go. And what I discovered when I came out of silence, then things would become clearer.
Yes.
Because when I had been clutching things so much constantly, I lost perspective. But being able to clear out the stuff.
Absolutely.
I could come back to it and see it with greater clarity. And to this day, having done that discipline for 3 months, for 2 hours, 1 hour at the beginning of the day, 1 hour at the end, my body still remembers that posture. So yeah. when I straighten my spine, I yawn and I go back into that relaxed space. It's a physical kind of thing. My guess is, you describe yourself as an ox. What is it about that ox that you take care of? What is it about your body that you take care of now? And how do you know you need to do that?
I know I need to start looking at my self-care when I notice things are slacking. I notice I'm not spending time praying. I notice my fuse for my temper is starting to get short. I notice a situation where normally I would be giving more, and I'm starting to hold back a little bit and protect myself. Physically, I am horrible at taking care of myself physically. I really am. That is an area
I need some serious growth.
Yeah. Luckily, my fiance is very big on taking care of herself, and she's trying to train me. So, uh-huh. So there's hope.
And can you do that collaboratively, or is that competitive at this point?
It's collaborative. Okay. It's collaborative. Yeah. So physically I'm learning to take care of myself. For the longest time, that ox aspect of just going full steam ahead and plowing through, I'm not 20 anymore.
Right. No, it catches up with you.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
Yeah. Mike, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Thank you so much.
Now, you wanted to close with, For Today and
yes,
Fearless.
Yes.
You want to say a bit about that before we started?
I would. The idea of the song is being fearless, not letting our decisions be made by fear. The vocalist in this song is talking about his identity is in Christ, so he doesn't have anything to fear. in this world. So often fear prevents people from establishing a real relational connection with someone. And all the people experiencing homelessness, all the brokenness where I've built a relationship with someone, every single time there is a traumatic factor that has happened where they have been deeply wounded and they just can't overcome it. Right. I would love to see us as a community be fearless and let our decisions be made out of love and not out of fear.
Right. Thank you.